I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. With school back in session, we spend the hour with Dr. Sonia Santalises, CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. Test scores for city students rose for the first time in nearly a decade. Charm City kids outperformed students in nearly all other school systems in the area, including posting reading scores at nearly double the state average. Lots of kids return to brand new state-of-the-art buildings, but others who go to school in buildings that have long been plagued by aging infrastructure, well, not so much. And the Kerwin Commission is expected to release its long-awaited report soon. What will those recommendations mean for the way school funding is determined in Baltimore and beyond? Dr. Sonia Santalises joins me when Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. With the new school year underway, we thought it was a good time to check in with Baltimore City Public Schools CEO, Dr. Sonia Santalises, who joins me here in Studio A for the hour. Some kids in the city and in Baltimore County and elsewhere couldn't go to school last week, or they were dismissed early on a few days because their classrooms weren't air-conditioned. Others began the year in brand new state-of-the-art buildings constructed under the 21st Century Schools program. Unlike school systems in some of the counties adjacent to Baltimore, city schools have faced shrinking enrollment for many years, a persistent problem that speaks to the larger challenges Baltimore faces attracting and keeping young families. Declining enrollment, of course, affects funding. Changing the formula for how schools are funded is one of the mandates of the Kerwin Commission, which is expected to release its long-awaited report this month or early next month. Dr. Santalises has made it a priority to increase the academic performance of city students, and the latest PARC test results show some improvement. PARC stands for Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers, and the latest scores for elementary and middle school kids in math and reading improved for the first time since 2010. Some fourth and eighth graders in Baltimore are reading at a level twice as high as the statewide average. That's the good news. The bad news, fewer than one in five kids passed the test. And as Liz Bowie in the Baltimore Sun reports just this morning, the PARC test itself gets a failing grade from the folks at the State Department of Education, who plan to replace it with a different assessment test in a couple of years. You can join the conversation with Dr. Santalises on the WIPR Facebook page, where we are streaming live, and a little later in the program, we'll take your calls and comments. It's good to see you, ma'am. Welcome back.
Good to be here. Good to be here.
So let's talk about the air conditioning first.
Sure.
As I understand it, about 63 different schools had problems last week, but those problems are now resolved because it's cooler, or where do things stand as we speak?
Yeah, basically, we are very happy that we have cooler temperatures yesterday and today. And so that has enabled the buildings to cool down. That started last Friday. And now everybody is back in school. And we're really happy for that full day. We did all schools began last week, but we did have, as you noted, about 63 approximately on a given day that we had to release early.
And so at the Board of Estimates meeting last week, the governor, as I understand it from Brian Sears' reporting and the Daily Record and some other things I've read, the governor seemed to blame you for this problem. And Peter Francho, who also sits on the Board of Estimates, seemed to blame Mike Miller and Mike Bush because of the legislative shenanigans that went on around the oversight of this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the governor, once again, you know, seems to express publicly and purposefully his, you know, basic distrust of the administration at North Avenue and the capacity that your folks have to do the job. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think one of the things that I said to the Baltimore Sun when they called, and I've said continually, is one, we had a plan, we submitted that plan, we were actually applauded for the plan, and we have maintained updates based on, one, the cost of installing air conditioning, and the pace, the bids, all of those things that anyone in public financing of projects and bids know happen. And I feel like as a professional, it's my responsibility to keep folks updated. We did do that. We submitted those memos that we had forwarded to keep the state updated on the progress. And those memos all indicated where we were in the process. And I noted some of those challenges, but we are generally on track. And a matter of fact, what we're going to be doing is moving forward really publicly, putting it on our website and updating it as we go, so that actually the public can see. Because I think sometimes we get caught back, and I'm not going to get in a back and forth politically. I think sometimes it's convenient. I am a student of the moment, and I know the moment that we are in our state right now, as we have a lot of politics going back and forth. And I don't play politics.
Yes. One may have heard that it's an election year.
Sure, yeah. And you said that. I didn't. but I think, you know, the real piece for me is, again, we've kept the state updated. That is what professionals do. I think it's convenient sometimes for the public to latch on to a narrative that is familiar to them. But we submitted that to the Sun. We submitted our memos. We've kept them updated. Our board, we have a public progression of contracts. We had one. A matter of fact, I was at the mayor's cabinet meeting yesterday and spoke with a colleague who apologized and said, I know, because of historical preservation, we're keeping one of your contracts. And I mean, he acknowledged it as well. So I think, look, the bottom line is what we're going to be doing is putting the information for the public so that then there's no spin on what the information actually is. And for a lot of those buildings, the 7, I guess, that were referenced, we are making progress on those. And in the places where we can, it's because we're not going to bypass the bid process, because for me, that's real accountability, is making sure that you are doing with the public's money what is ethical, what is within the guidelines, and keeping folks abreast. So the good thing to come out of all of this is that we're actually not going to leave that information limited to back and forth memos. We're going to let the public know where we are.
And the plan, as I understand it, is to complete 12 schools this year in 2018 to install air conditioning, another 28 in 2019, 18 in 2020. So there are all these things lined up. And again, when you talk about the bid process, it's the procurement process itself.
That's exactly
that,
right.
Remains a problem. I mean, we talked last winter when there was a heating problem and kids were going home or, shivering.
Right.
And it's because some of the other jurisdictions, Baltimore County, for example, which has something like 90 schools that don't have air conditioning as of 7 years ago, and now they have 8, so they've drastically cut down the number of schools without air conditioning. But they pay for it up front.
That's right.
And then get reimbursed because they've got the money on hand. The city schools and the city government doesn't have that money. Mm-hmm. That money only comes out of the city school budget rather than Mayor Pugh's budget. Do I understand that
well
correctly?
And I think what happens is that the amount, so we had typically received about $17 million from the city. This year the mayor increased it to $19 million, but when you compare $19 million to forward fund anything compared to $184 million, I think, in Baltimore County, or $194 million investment in Montgomery County, the situation that you're referencing is what arises. And so, again, people can come up with whatever their convenient one-liner Twitter tweet text is. But look, when we look at the complexity of the system that has been set up, we had both Republican and Democratic legislators, when we talked about that recycling of funds, members of both parties said, this is wrong, and we need to change it. And we worked with the IAC to do that. The legislature backed us in that. So again, I think it's convenient. I understand the context that we live in, but I'm about moving the work, and it's about making sure that we do it in a way that then does not leave us exposed for then a backlash of not following procurement procedures. And that is part of what we're doing. We're making steady pace. I was out in the community this weekend and had a number of people in Baltimore City who completely understood. They said, we get it. You made it clear. What we're going to do, though, is, like I said, we're going to keep our public, the public, informed, so that it's not backroom memos. it's actually the public knowing. And so it's a good lesson in that, that if you rely on backroom memos, sometimes the story gets misshapen. But if you actually release the information to people, people know. People are smart.
The plan, when you had a budget for this year and the capital improvement budget, called for 5 new schools to open this year. So did they all open?
They did.
They were wonderful.
They were very exciting. And just, you know, I've said before that I just have the privilege of being here and being the CEO when these open. But, you know, you have people. I talked to Tisha Edwards, the former chief of staff. She did yeoman's work on this. Andres Alonso, who was my boss at the time, who really pushed for this. Michael Sarbanes, who really got out front and mobilized. And so this is a cumulative effort, former board members. And what is so wonderful about those spaces, the best part of walking in those schools is seeing the faces of young people who immediately know that this space is different. This says something different. Many of them, I don't think, realized that they could be in buildings and spaces that look like these new schools. And it was a collective community effort. It really, really was. And it's what makes, again, some of the rancor in the stratosphere, you know, easy to dismiss, because we have in these new schools evidence of what happens when an entire community mobilizes around its children. And so it's been wonderful. So, and again, and I invite you again to come visit a couple.
Well, I drive by one. I drive by Dorothy Haight Elementary Middle, which is, you know, right in my neighborhood. And we actually are making plans, we hope, to have a show to broadcast midday from Dorothy Haight Elementary Middle at some point in the next few months, because we do take the show on the road every so often. So I look forward to it, and it's gorgeous. I mean, it's just a gorgeous building, and it's a fundament and a meeting place for the community. It's not just the children. I mean, it's the rest of us who live there. How about closing buildings, though? I mean, part of the issue with air conditioning, heating, and stuff is that you don't want to throw good money after bad. You got these buildings that have, you know, they're a bazillion years old, and it's just, you know, getting them up to code and up to speed is really going to be hard. So you got to make tough decisions given the enrollment challenges and given the particular challenges of these schools. Does the closing of schools happen on a particular calendar? I mean, do you always announce, you know, in the spring, next year this school isn't going to be open and the kids at this school are going to go to these other places?
Yeah.
How does that work?
So it is a very complex process. And I will say the staff, our Office of New Initiatives, our operations folks do an amazing job in really coordinating and planning all this. So with the 21st century schools, the beauty of that process was we were able to, as a district, and again, this is because of the previous work that I referenced before of folks, but we as a district were able to close schools, which is always painful for a community, but to say, now you have Dorothy I. Haight, right? So in the case of 21st century schools, communities know a couple of years in advance, right, that a particular school is closing. Every year in the fall, our board reviews our portfolio of schools. So we review, for example, charter applications that have been forwarded to us from the Charter Advisory Board, and we make recommendations around those. But then we also propose a series of closures each year based on the population. Now, the challenge is 21st century, when the 21st century school plan was first designed, it was designed to take care of most of that underutilization. The challenge is that the population of the city has further decreased since that plan. And so now we're finding ourselves with what we thought was the fix, was 21st century schools, and we are closing those schools according to plan. Now, though, we're finding a need to close additional schools because of utilization challenges.
And one more comment about the governor before we take a quick break. He announced last week that he was, by executive order, establishing a thing he calls the Office of Education Accountability. This is a thing that he tried to have passed as a bill in the legislature last year, and it never got out of committee to a vote. And it will oversee funding, building conditions, grade fixing, and other improprieties that he's quite concerned about, particularly in Prince George's County. He had an ongoing tete-a-tete with, or you know, a kerfluffle with deceased Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz about the air conditioning there. He's, as we've mentioned, complained about you. So he's got issues with accountability, what he calls accountability. What does that mean? What is this new Office of Accountability, which is going to be run by Peter Franchot's advisor for education, a woman named Valerie Radomski? What is the effect of this on the people on your staff on North Avenue in terms of reporting and in terms of what it actually means for you? Is it duplicative of stuff that you're doing already? Is it welcome? I mean, what is it?
Well, I think in part we're all waiting to see, right? We're all waiting to see. I don't know in detail what the work of this new office will be. I mean, we know generally speaking, but I think for those of us in the field, we're going to wait. We're going to see what that looks like. So I can't speak because I don't know the details in particular. I will say this, that we already as Baltimore City undergo probably more audits than any other jurisdiction. We go through them regularly. We have people pulling files on a regular basis, that we have a legislative audit. So actually the current administration is, you know, is actually overseeing a legislative audit. We meet, I've said before, that actually, you know, a lot of the folks who, you know, who work with the governor have been very good when we've reported on our financial plan. You know, we were required based on the money that the state forwarded to us 2 years ago when I came. We're required to report to them regularly. There has been no whisperings of misappropriation or mismanagement. So when we go through all of those, yes, we always find things that we can improve. And I will always say that. And I think any real leader always can point to places where we can all improve. And I consider myself or want to be part of that, those ranks. And so we do that. But for us, we already are undergoing what I like to affectionately call an audit colonoscopy series, because we have so many people.
There's a technical term.
Yeah, you like that, yeah. Right? Because we do. We have so many people coming in at auditing. And again, you know, people will surface things that we have to improve. And even, for example, with with the heating and air conditioning challenges, we are partnering with a number of private, organizations, private businesses, construction, energy companies in the city nationally who, fortunately for them and fortunately for us, didn't reach out and criticize, but actually said, how can we help? And you know what they're telling me, Tom, when they're looking like, wow, you guys are doing this with this little bit? That's what folks in private industry are saying. So part of why, again, I can't talk about something that I don't know how it's going to operate. But Baltimore City is always, it's already under a lot of scrutiny. Baltimore City Public Schools already has numerous audits going on. And we actually have invited members who want to be helpful from the private sector. And, you know, we always, that's another thing, we conveniently reference the private sector. Well, we're actually proactively bringing those people in. They're coming in alongside of us. And yes, they're finding things that can improve. But more often than not, they are startled and stunned that we are doing as well with the resources we have. They can't believe how little resources we have.
Dr. Sonia Sonalesis is with me today here in Studio A. She's the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. When we come back from a break, you're welcome to join our conversation. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, another in our series of conversations with the candidates. Susan Turnbull is the Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor. She's running with Ben Jealous. We'll spend the hour with her tomorrow here on Midday. Hope you can join us then. If you're just joining us today, Dr. Sonia Sonalesis is my guest. She is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. You are welcome to be part of our conversation. We'll do our best to include some of your calls and comments. 410-662-8780 is the phone number. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR, to follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming. So, Dr. Sonalesis, in terms of enrollment, I know you don't take a real census of the kids until school's had a few weeks to, you know, under its belt. But do you have a sense that the trend of declining enrollment is, you know, continuing to decline dramatically, or is it evening off? Do you have any notion of it at this juncture?
Honestly, I don't know. And part of that is because we had such a crazy week last week. So with schools dismissing half days, you know, having about 60 plus schools dismissing with half days, it really is hard to, you know, it's really hard to take a full count. I will say this, that what we are finding is in the schools where we are really seeing school leadership come together with principals and teachers, we're seeing fairly, you know, fairly steady, steady enrollment. Some of those schools, but to be honest, we, given the kind of crazy opening we had in terms of just half days and things like that, it's hard for me to talk about that now.
How about teacher recruitment and retention? We heard a month and a half ago about a number of Filipino teachers who had been recruited by the school system, brought to Baltimore, and then all of a sudden they were deported. Have any of those been able to get the proper paperwork and come back?
Oh my gosh, and it is wonderful news. I get emails from a lot of them all the time. So as soon as, I think I got the first one, both myself and Chief Grant Skinner, who heads up Human Capital, we started getting letters back that people actually were receiving some of their certification papers. So we're going to be getting a large number of those Filipino teachers back. I don't know if it's exactly all of them now, but a lot of the teachers that unfortunately had to leave will be coming back. As a matter of fact, I was visiting Bluford Jew Jemison, and they lost a physics and a chem teacher, and they were thrilled, and that principal held their space for them, because it was just such a wonderful teacher, does wonderful work with the kids. So we're thrilled about that. That's a definite win for all of us.
Was this year usual or unusual in terms of the number of people who you were able to retain, the number of spots you had open before school started?
No, great question. So we had less openings this year, and we got openings filled faster this year. We still had approximately the same number, which is about 600 teachers. And so part of the work that we're doing to stem some of that, I'm having roundtables with teachers, different groups of teachers throughout the year. Our Human Capital Office is working with a number of teacher leadership organizations. We have a new Black Teacher Retention Advisory Group that is doing some great work. I'm looking forward to seeing what they come up with, because we're seeing that we're losing large numbers of our Black teachers, and so we're really trying to get at that. So we still
and the numbers of Black teachers aren't very high to begin with.
Thank you. And what was stunning to me was when I saw the figures of the number of Black teachers when I departed Baltimore the first time as chief academic officer, was gone 3 years, and the amount of decline just between those three, the time I left and the time I returned, was staggering for me. I mean, I think we lost an additional 18% to 20%. And it was then that I knew, even having worked in a place where I looked at this and had a team that did some really great work at the Ed Trust, and they still do, and I would direct people there. They've done, Education Trust has done great work on this issue of teachers of color, Black and Latino teachers. And then when I came back and saw it in my own district, that's when we knew we really needed to do something about it. And there were some real courageous African-American teachers who requested a meeting with me and really shared some of their experiences. And they are completely committed to the kids, but some of the challenges that they were running into matched what I had seen in the national data on Black teachers when I was at Ed Trust. And, you know, the work of people like Travis Bristol, who is amazing and has done fabulous research in this area. So I'm really proud and encouraged by the work of that group. And, you know, and the fact that teacher leadership, what we know, And one of the data points we're tracking now is that we hadn't tracked previously when we were looking at kind of principal performance is what does the churn of teachers look like at particular schools? And so it was very quiet in the meeting I had with principals at the beginning of this year when I said to them, we're going to be looking at the data. And,
So to a certain extent, the retention of teachers needs to be laid at the principal's feet?
Yeah. I mean, but I think it's a system piece. And I think we all have to own it. I think that's more of what I'm saying is that we all have to own it. So if there are things at the district level that we need to do better, like making sure teachers don't have to go through 50 million hoops to get their paycheck and that there's somebody who's responsive on the phone and that they're not waiting on hold. I mean, those are the bottom line issues that teachers talk about. And that combined with the challenges of particular groups of teachers, whether it's new teachers, African-American teachers, we're taking a deeper look. But it was a way of signaling to school leaders, it's all of our challenge. And we have schools that we don't have lots of churn of teachers, and the teachers love being there.
Like in terms of teachers of color, does the school system, actively recruit? I mean, are you going to job fairs at mm-hmm. Morgan State or Howard or the HBCUs around in the area or even outside the area? I mean, are there things that proactively the district can do to say that, Baltimore City is an attractive place to work. Mm-hmm. Teaching is a good profession. Mm-hmm. Professional development. When I've talked to teachers, and we had a panel of teachers on the air just here a few weeks ago about the importance of professional development, mentoring.
Yes.
I mean, are those the
yes.
kinds of things that you're going to able to up a little bit?
Well, and we do. Past? And I will say this, that, if you're very interested, you might want to have a conversation with Jeremy Grant Skinner, our chief human capital officer, who actually waxed prolific about this very issue at our most recent board meeting. And one of the things that he reminded us all, and that is that Maryland overall has a teacher shortage. Maryland as a state, we do not produce enough teachers to fill all of the vacancies. And even if you look at HBCUs, within the state, if we were only reliant on those schools, we wouldn't have nearly enough to fill our spaces. So I think it is a multi-pronged effort. And what we're saying in this, and I've said this to staff, that we have probably a bigger retention issue than we do a recruitment issue. There are lots of folks who want to give of themselves to some of our children who have been least invested in. We just have to do the work of giving them the conditions and the support to stay.
Liz Bowie, again, the education reporter for The Sun, who does great work on that beat and has for many years, reported last week that about 28,000 of the state's 59,000 teachers, right? So about half have less than a decade teaching experience. So that also mm-hmm. matters when it
yes,
comes
it
to
does.
Academic performance, when it comes to a climate and a culture of a school. Mm-hmm. If you've got a bunch of newbies all the time, God bless them that they're new and they're trying and they're involved. But boy, a teacher with 10, 15 years experience is a very invaluable person.
No, you're absolutely right. And one of the data points that we analyze and that we watch is where are the schools where there's a concentration of new teachers? And one of the things that I knew even as chief academic officer years ago that we needed to work on was the high numbers, the high percentages of new teachers almost concentrated in some of our lowest performing schools. And so part of what we've done is begun really looking very deliberately at that data, looking at how do you build a full leadership team. And you're absolutely right. If you have a high performing teacher with 15 years experience, it's just different. And not because we don't have fabulous third year teachers that are doing incredible work, because we do. But I know, and I tell people, I often look back to that class of students that I taught in Brooklyn years ago, my first year, and think, oh my God, I hope they had somebody that next year who knew more than I certainly knew at that time.
Yeah, I taught high school for a year in 1977. It was the hardest job I've ever had.
Absolutely.
It was one of the most gratifying jobs I've ever had, but also hard as can be. Speaking of churn, you did a little churning yourself when it came to principals. You reassigned some folks. Some of the people that you reassigned had some pretty high profiles. Principal Rowe at the Renaissance Academy, no longer there. Many of these people, again, like when you say you're going to close a school building, the community has strong feelings about that. In many cases, when you say you're going to reassign or remove a principal, those parents in that community have strong feelings about it as well. Your philosophy behind making those moves?
So, and one of the things that, and again, you know, clearly I'm not going to talk about individual personnel issues, but I will say from a philosophy standpoint, one of the things that Chief John Davis, who oversees the school leadership and, right, so all of the principal supervisors and the principals, and one of the things that we are absolutely on the same page about is that folks, school leaders deserve to have goals set and time to reach those goals and support to do so. But there does come a time when we have to ask ourselves the hard question. I mean, that is part of what I get paid to do, right? You know, I don't get paid to get caught up in political shenanigans, but I do get paid, and I take it very seriously to make sure that every school has a high quality leader. And there are also ebbs and flows. There are times when a leader might have been good for one particular place, but with regard to the acceleration, to the growth that we want to see in young people, it's time for a change. And it's not just based, you know, sometimes people think, oh, it's just because of the test scores. It's not. We have committed to walking in most of the schools where we, and I try to get to as many as I can, where we think, you know, there might be challenges. And so I've walked in some of schools. I've seen the learning going on in classrooms. This is not a knee-jerk park score up down decision. This is about what's the movement in the environment. And I have said very clearly, and I said this when I met with the editorial board at The Sun, that there are schools whose scores did not go up this year, but because of the environment, because of the leadership, because of the progress being made, the quality of the teachers being recruited and supported, I know those schools will eventually pop on whatever the state test is. But what's most important is the learning occurring in the classroom and what young people are doing. And so we have to have both. We have to have nurturing school environments,
yes. It's not all just by the numbers.
It's not by the numbers. And anybody who knows me will tell you that. Like, that's why we work. Every principal this year is having a goal-setting meeting where they will set and talk about the goals. They look at their trajectory in their schools. This is not an I gotcha. This is not a knee-jerk. I don't operate that way. But we also owe the public, and we owe families, and we owe kids movement, and movement in learning. And movement in learning will eventually show in any test result that's out there.
And I owe my listeners a chance to get involved in the conversation. Jill in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sanalesis.
Good morning, Tom. Good morning, Dr. Sanalesis. Last June, the school board passed the Baltimore Arts Education Initiative designed to address some of the deficiencies in arts education, the system, like only having half the schools have a music teacher, for example. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about how that plan is going to be implemented, and also how does it relate to the blueprint for success?
Great question, Jill.
And we should mention, I've known Jill for quite a while. She is an arts educator from way back.
Well,
in the city school system.
Then even more so, Jill, thank you for all your work in city schools. So number one, I think the piece, and Jill may even know this, but that I'm most proud of with that plan, that arts plan, is one, we did it in coordination with many community leaders in the Baltimore arts community. So these were on the ground artists, art educators who understood the limited resources and said, even with that, how can we work to make sure that we are increasing the access of arts for young people in Baltimore City? We do have a kind of full implementation plan that I won't even confess to know back and forth with my, you know, to know by heart. But I will say this, Jill, that one of the things that we're doing is really looking and tracking very closely the number of arts teachers within the district, certified art teachers. We are also doing kind of a review of where arts, the time with arts and arts exposure for each school. And part of the implementation plan actually begins this fall. So, you know, in reviewing, one of the questions that we've been asking when it's budget time with schools, which is when a lot of those decisions get made, is now some real targeted questions around the arts support within schools that I think before we asked, but it wasn't as weighty, I should say, a question. I think the second piece that we're looking forward to, and I am looking forward to, is just the sequencing of arts experiences for kids. So making sure that we're at a place where we can name for every young person in Baltimore City where they are in their arts development, what arts exposure they've had. Again, I don't know offhand, Jill, exactly where we are in that timeline, but I would invite you and anyone else, actually, to the website. If it's not posted, I'll make sure that it gets posted. And again, because I am increasingly believe that the more of these kinds of timelines and things that we release to the public, the more we update them, then the public can. And I think that's the intent, is for the public to also do. But I'm really excited. And with regards to the blueprint, it really is one of the underpinnings of student wholeness. And I will never forget my first year talking to one of our high school students who said, look, I'll do your algebra for you, but I actually love art. And I only have one or two art classes as a high school student that I can take. And I have carried that with me. And what we are really moving towards with the blueprint is acknowledging that, one, young people have all different kinds of talents and reasons for why they connect to academic learning, but also recognizing what just makes you a whole person. And the arts just makes you whole. I'm not a virtuoso like Tom is in playing the flute. I only lasted a couple of years. I am not an amazing painter like my youngest daughter, Francesca. But I will tell you, I am made better because there are artists, and art says something about the values of a community. And so that is part of what we are rebuilding. So Jill is absolutely on point. The arts plan is intimately tied to the blueprint work.
We'll have more with Baltimore City Public Schools CEO Dr. Sonia Sonalesis when we return from a quick break. 410-662-8780 to drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, to send us a tweet @MiddayWIPR. You can also catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. Before we take a break, every week here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who've lost their lives to violence in the previous week. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we pause for a moment of silence to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 200 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. 6 men were the victims of homicide last week. They ranged in age from 21 to 53. Their identities have yet to be released by the police. We will read their names when they are made public. Today, of course, we are also commemorating the anniversary of the attacks in New York and Washington and the crash of a plane in Pennsylvania in 2001. 63 people from Maryland were killed on this day 17 years ago. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, Dr. Sonia Sonalesis is my guest. She is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. We are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. We're taking tweets @MiddayWIPR. We're taking emails, midday@wipr.org. And we're taking phone calls if you'd like to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780. So, Dr. Sonalesis, let me read you an email from Bridget. And this is, I sometimes don't take these emails like this one that are about a very specific question about a very specific thing. But I want to share it with listeners because this is the kind of thing that your office deals with all the time.
Absolutely.
So as an example of something that's indicative of the kinds of things you folks do, Bridget writes, I have two children in the Baltimore City Public Schools. My sixth grader went through the middle school choice process last week, and as part of the school choice process, the system does not distinguish between excused and unexcused absences in making these decisions. In other words, attending her grandfather's funeral counted against my daughter when it came to her middle school choice. So does the school system have a plan for changing this policy to acknowledge the difference between excused and unexcused absences, specifically when it comes to school choice? So, Bridget, we send our condolences about your daughter's grandfather. And this is the kind of, these are the questions that come into North Avenue.
Without a doubt, 85% of the calls or questions are these. And what I would say to Bridget and to everyone is that it is also through a lot of questions like these that we are made aware of policy wrinkles, practice wrinkles that we wouldn't normally, we wouldn't normally know if we didn't have parents and families like Bridget surfacing them. So in this case, what I would say to Bridget or anyone who is concerned that an excused absence significantly impacted their students, their child's choice selection, to please definitely contact our enrollment office. And what we have done in the past when people think that things are negatively impacted, we definitely will take that into consideration. If you feel as if you can't get through on that end, I would also recommend that you reach out directly to Karen Lawrence, who is my ombudsman. She's the CEO's ombudsman, and she's very good at helping parents who feel like they've exhausted a number of channels, still don't have what they need. I'm sure she's going to be thrilled that I said the name of her office on air. But I would also say to Bridget, so I would check with enrollment. If she wants to send an email, she could even send it to the CEO of City Schools email, and I can forward it to our academic officer and make sure. But we are also, just for the general listening audience, we are also taking a big look at our choice process this year and how we help clarify, how we strengthen. We have parents who know the system like the back of their hands. We have others who don't because they're running around trying to do life. And so we're making a real effort as the district. The Baltimore Plan for Excellence did a wonderful report for us on our choice process. And what we found was that there's still a lot of families that are being left out of having full choice. And so this is a great time for Bridget to ask this question as we're doing this revamping.
All right. Thanks for that email, Bridget. We have a question from Sid on Facebook, which is the same question I have, which is your reaction to the Kerwin Commission. Not a reaction, because you don't have anything to react to yet.
Sure.
Britt Kerwin was on the show a few weeks ago talking about the various goals that they have. One of them is teacher retention and teacher professional development. The other is early childhood education. There are two or three more. I mentioned at the top of the show that the PARC tests, which have been the bane of some teachers' existence, if you talk to them, is now on the way out the door. There's going to be some other, you know, replacement. And one of the criticisms of PARC was that it took so much time. So, you know, we talked about arts education and arts offerings. You know, maybe the less if there's an assessment tool that takes less time, maybe there's more chance for arts programs and other things to flourish. But in general, what are you looking for? And that's a very tiny piece of a very big puzzle.
Sure.
That the Kerwin Commission is wrestling with. Whatever they recommend, chances are it's going to be really, really expensive. And chances are that it will the indications are it will suggest some fairly radical deviation from the current way schools are funded, including the city of Baltimore, so that it will take into consideration the differences of the challenges that you face as opposed to your counterpart in Charles County or St. Mary's County or on the Eastern Shore or something. So what have you heard about it? What are you hoping it's going to say? And then what's your next play once it comes out?
So I would first say that that Dr. Kerwin has been really wonderful and thoughtful about the different needs of young people. And so we've had the opportunity to talk on a number of occasions. And he understands concentrated poverty. I think the challenge that the Kerwin Commission is going to have, I think that there's some really great people who want to do wonderful things for schools in Maryland. The challenge is often translation. So we've talked about concentrated poverty, but we're not the only ones. I actually have colleagues on the Eastern Shore who are also talking about concentrated poverty and other school districts. We clearly have probably the most aggravated in that sense challenges.
No, but it's absolutely. We did a live broadcast from Chestertown, which is
there
a community that you think is a fairly affluent community, and it is in many ways.
Yep.
But they have a number of students struggling
exactly.
with poverty.
Exactly. And it's one of the things that unites us. And that's why I said that. It's not just because I'll see them at a meeting, superintendent's meeting on Friday. But it is a question. I think, though, the challenge is in the interpretation and the impact. And so my caution to the Kerwin Commission as they do their work and as we interpret that is, for example, I've heard people say, well, community schools are the answer to poverty. Well, community schools are part of the answer to poverty. But if you think that you're just going to add one community school organizer, right, and, you know, an additional halftime mental health professional, and oops, now we can wipe our hands clean, we've dealt with concentrated poverty, then I would say the implementation is not reflective of the depth of conversation and analysis that I know at least Dr. Kerwin and some of the folks on that commission are. And I think that's the challenge. The challenge is, at least for the city, are we going to see things like early childhood education through the needs of young people in poverty? Are we going to see, for example, we talk about guidance counselors and, oh, we need more kids, you know, getting college and career, advisement and guidance. Well, for a first generation college goer living in concentrated poverty, that need is accentuated. So again, if we're going to have simplistic surface definitions of poverty where we think, oh, just add a community school coordinator and now everything's better, then we're just kidding ourselves. And we're not really going to get the lift out of the commission's work that I think the state of Maryland is looking for. And I've said this before, you know, communities have to decide the extent to which they will fund and invest in their future generations. And I've lived through the cycle in various states. My home state of Massachusetts did it years ago, and everybody wanted to talk about our high standards. And
the Kerwin Commission holds up Massachusetts as a paradigm for what Maryland should be emulating.
Well, then they need to look at the funding discussions that are happening. You can't have that level of education and then invest like my dad's home state, of Mississippi. And I know the state commissioner, you know, in Mississippi. They're doing fabulous work in Mississippi. And it's a both and, right? It's standards, it's accountability, and it's investment. And I reject, and it's just because of the way I was raised, the way I was educated, I reject overly simplistic responses to situations that have developed over years. And I guess in our Twitter feed world, right now, we want a one-liner to solve things that took centuries to become a problem. And so what we're saying is if we're going to talk about concentrated poverty, you have to look at the impact of poverty in all of these other areas. Because if you are a teacher teaching young people where 18% of them come from poverty, 18 out of 20 of them have had to deal with violence and God only knows what else. That is different than being in a classroom where one or two young people have dealt with that. And so the preparation, the support that you need is different. I mean, we have teachers, frankly, suffering secondary trauma based on some of the stories that their kids are telling. We have large numbers of students of color who have felt, you know, who have not been connected in positive ways with their identity and with their history. So Kerwin's got to take the full.
Plenty more to talk about and no time to do it. So we will have
that.
You. No. We will have you on again. Of course, it's always good to check in with you regularly.
Okay.
So I appreciate your coming by, Dr. Sanalisis.
No, thank you.
Dr. Sonia Sanalisis is the CEO of the Baltimore City Public Schools. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Susan Turnbull joins me for the hour here in Studio A. She's the Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor and her running mate Former NAACP Director Ben Jealous will join me next Tuesday. And by the way, later this week on Friday, Johnny Olszewski Jr., who's running for Baltimore County Executive, will be here. And then his opponent, Maryland Insurance Commissioner Al Redmer, will be here a week from tomorrow. Early voting begins in 6 weeks on October 25th. Election Day is November 6th. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. They've got locations and hours at joesquared.com. By the way, the lunch choice today for Baltimore City Elementary Schools, Dr. Sonalisis, here's your choice. Steak sub, cheesesteak sub, deli sandwich, hummus plate, steamed carrots, or autumn salad. What are you going with?
So I gotta tell you, the healthy part of me would be the autumn salad, but I'm going for the cheesesteak, Doc.
I'm sorry, that is incorrect. You should have gone with the deli sandwich.
Really?
Yes, but better luck next time. I definitely would. All right, I'm Tom Hall, here and now, coming up next after the news at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.